the Labor Party and the new Fish Minister for Fisheries at the time, Stuart Nash, met with the fishing industry and came out of that meeting saying that there would be no cameras on the fishing fleet, which contradicted the national government. You know, who would have thought the national government's promise to have cameras on every fishing vessel by October last year. So 4 days after forming a coalition government, they actually moved back on their promises from before the election and said, no, actually this isn't such a priority for us after all.
Kia ora, greetings and welcome to Planet FM 104.6. I'm Tim Lynch and I trust that you are doing well. I invite you to stay with me over the next hour as we discuss and find ways to take care of our unique and magnificent green planet Earth.
And welcome. I'm Lisa Eyre and this is Green Planet FM. Today I have in the studio Christine Rose. Now, Christine is a campaign advisor for the World Animal Protection, continuing her decades-long advocacy for a better protection for Maui and Hector's dolphins. In her role in this global animal welfare organisation, Christine applies her knowledge of politics and love of philosophy into the new frontier of animal ethics, working to move the world for animals' welfare and rights. It's lovely to have you in the studio, Christine.
Kia ora. Thank you, Lisa.
Now, Christine, currently you're involved in the New Zealand Dolphins Threat Management Plan. Could you explain what that is and why we need to make submissions before the 19th of this month?
Thanks, Lisa. Maui and Hector's dolphins are the world's rarest and smallest marine dolphin. They're only found in New Zealand and they're under serious threat of extinction, mostly due to entanglement in set and trawl nets. The government has recognised the seriousness of this issue and are developing a management process that will guide actions for the next 5 or 10 years that the government are currently consulting on, and that will identify the range of threats facing the dolphins and potential intervention or response measures that hopefully will stop them from becoming extinct.
Okay, so primarily it's fishing that's causing this problem, is it?
That's right. Where the cause of death is known, up to about 90% of deaths from human causes are caused by net entanglement. There are a range of other threats caused by humans, some of which the scale and gravity is unknown and speculated only. For example, toxoplasmosis that comes from cats and makes its way into the marine environment. It affects a range of other species, and tests on tests on carcasses found toxo present in 9 dolphins. And from that, the government scientists have extrapolated that it might be killing up to 300 Hector's dolphins a year, although that's seriously disputed by some of the experts in the field.
I'm going to stop you there. How on earth can toxoplasmosis in cats get to dolphins in the water?
It's a question that is widely raised, and it's true that toxoplasmosis is widespread in the environment generally. So women get it, but humans get it, and it is a risk to pregnant women, and it can affect people's behaviour. So they tend to act a bit more schizophrenic if they're suffering from toxoplasmosis. Parts of the life cycle of the toxo mean that when the cysts burst, it can be widespread and distributed, so sheep can suffer from it. The connection to the marine environment is speculated that it comes through flushing of kitty litter or cat feces down through water systems into the marine environment.
Uh-huh.
But certainly some scientists say that that risk is overstated, and they are concerned that given the disease's prevalence in the marine environment or in the general environment, that this is a distraction from the point source issues and causes of death that are going to be more important for us to tackle.
So that's primarily trawling, the trawling along the bottom?
That's right. So the two fishing methods that are killing these dolphins are set and trawl netting, collectively called gill netting, because that's the type of net that we're talking about, monofilament nylon nets that are suspended either or dragged in the water column, and the dolphins swim along, and as smart as they are and as finely tuned to the marine environment as they are unable largely to detect these nets. They get caught in them and struggle, often get more entangled, often suffer serious injuries and drown over a period of quite some minutes in a way that we would not find acceptable for any other animal on the planet, whether it's a cat, a dog or a cow, and yet we turn a blind eye to that suffering and those animal welfare impacts because it's bycatch.
And I suppose people think of dolphins as being water animals and forget that they have to come up for air.
That's right. And because they are air breathers, there's some evidence that shows as they are caught in a net, they'll hold their breath, and so that prolongs their suffering. Even if they got out of that net, they are likely to suffer severe welfare impacts, and they've been well catalogued in the science. And also because they're social groups, the social structure can be seriously upset by deaths of individuals. We know now, though, that sometimes huge groups of dolphins get killed at once. There are reports of 10, 20 dolphins in trawl nets. And even last year, there were several multi-death incidents. So 5 dolphins were killed just outside the current protection area at Banks Peninsula in February last year. And then there were several more incidents of 3, 2 and multiple dolphins being killed at once.
But on the whole, the fishing industry wouldn't tell us, would they?
No, unfortunately, there are very few observers on the fishing fleet. There have been increased levels of fishing observers on the fleet in the Maui dolphin habitat. And so the fishermen all say, we've never seen a Maui dolphin. It's because most of them have already been killed. And so the observers that have been increased in Maui territory are at the expense of hectares in the South Island. And so basically there's no monitoring or enforcement of the legal fishing effort, and there is no oversight of recreational set netting, and illegal set netting relies on members of the public largely to notify authorities. And so there's a whole lot of death that's going on out there that we just never hear about.
And can you explain set netting?
Set netting's often done recreationally, although protection measures that we got put in 2008 and then 2012 has reduced that impact, especially for Maui. But it's also sort of small scale, often done as a part-time way of life or lifestyle by people that have been in the sector for their whole lives. And so it's not a big economic driver, but it's held quite sacred by the people who do it as a way of life and a right. But they, you know, the fishermen do say, well, we don't want to kill a dolphin, and I'm sure very few people would willfully go out and kill dolphins, but unless we get on top of the set net and trawling, those dolphins continue to be killed, and if we fail to stop it, then we're complicit in that death.
And unlike a rat that has multiple babies, dolphins don't have, they have one or two, is it? And they only have them every 2 years?
Yeah, it is a challenge for Maui and Hector's dolphins. They mature late. They make a significant investment in their babies, so they don't breed, you know, they never have twins. They don't have babies every year. And they only live to maybe 20 years. And so their breeding opportunities are very limited. So when we're taking dolphins out of that population through nets in particular, it's at a rate that is more than the population can sustain. And so even though we have got some protected areas, as soon as those dolphins swim out of those protected areas, they're at risk. And the Banks Peninsula population in particular has been very well studied, and the evidence there shows that they're fine as long as they stay within the protected area, but the protected area doesn't cover their whole habitat, and in winter months they go further offshore, and the fishing operators fish the line. They fish right up to that line of that marine protected area, and so as soon as those dolphins go over that boundary, and because they're attracted to the prey species that the fishing companies are also targeting, there's clear evidence of that conflict between dolphins and fishing vessels such that they get killed.
Right. And dolphins don't go a long way out to sea and a lot deep down, do they?
No, that's right. And that's a particular characteristic of Maui and Hectors. They're very faithful to a specific range. And it means that even though the government talks about Hectors dolphins being 16,000 of them, this is a healthy population, the 16,000 figure is disputed, and they're not homogenous. So there are a whole lot of genetically and geographically distinct subpopulations of Hectors dolphins found around the South Island. And so there's the Banks Peninsula population, which is relatively healthy, although traditionally it's suffered seriously from entanglement, such that scientists had too many bodies to deal with when they were trying to assess the cause of death. But even subpopulations, for example, the Otago subpopulation has probably only got about 42 individuals, maybe fewer. And the South Coast subpopulation, again, genetically distinct. And scientists have said, actually, government, you need to manage these subpopulations because their evolutionary trajectories are of global significance. And yet we're managing them as if there are a whole lot of them. And actually, these tail end populations in Otago and the South Coast and in Marlborough Sounds don't really matter and they don't really need protecting. And the threat management plan actually says that We can tolerate up to 100 Hectors dolphin deaths a year, and you know that's acceptable. But from an animal welfare perspective, and from a value of individual life, that is so not acceptable. We should not, as a developed country, be sitting there and saying that it's okay to wipe out through greatly painful means 100 of these most precious dolphins and write that off as collateral damage.
I totally agree with you. I mean, I think that almost any New Zealander that you approach, you'd say, do you like dolphins? And they'd all say, yes, we do. Do you want to save dolphins? Yes, we'd like to.
Yes, and research from Whale and Dolphin Conservation found that New Zealanders are prepared to pay more for their fish and more in their taxes to keep these dolphins safe.
Well, I read today that apparently the Turakihi is now threatened.
Yeah, well, a lot of our quota fisheries are managed to within about 10 or 11% of their pre-harvest numbers. And so, you know, we've wiped out 90% and we think that managing them to a 10% baseline is appropriate. What we really suffer from is this diminishing baseline argument where we diminish these populations so badly and then we accept that that status quo is sufficient. But it does nothing to account for random events, disease, you know, uncertainty in the scientific modelling. And really, when you think about how abundant our oceans must have been before commercial harvesting and before the technology of nylon nets, for example, and that we're even our best managed species are to within about, you know, 90% of that gone, it seems a really short-sighted and inappropriate way to respond what is really a really important food source for a lot of people, as well as, you know, key to a well-functioning marine ecosystem.
We don't really hear much about this from the Green Party, do we? Or the government in general. But this is an opportunity that we've got now to make a submission as to what happens in the next 5 or so years. Is that correct?
Yeah, this is a really critical thing that New Zealanders should be engaged in. And even though it's yet another submission and it's a fairly cumbersome process, the threat management plan is unnecessarily complex. It gives a whole lot of options and sub-options. And there's been a lot of propaganda from the fishing industry about how they're such great marine stewards. And the launch of the TMP, the threat management plan, is not ironically coincided with a launch from the seafood industry about how good they are and how the livelihoods they provide for people. And, you know, the thing is that workers' rights and environmental rights abuses, so workers' abuses and environmental abuses, go hand in hand in this extractive industry, which is indiscriminate. And sure, it returns, you know, money for the New Zealand, for New Zealand Inc., but a lot of that goes into the hands of the fishing company owners and not so much into the workers, and certainly not much, if anything, back into marine stewardship.
Right, right. So, yeah, we've definitely got the wrong focus there, as we have in so many other areas, Christine.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Now, listeners, if you would like to make a submission on this, you can go to the www.worldanimalprotection.org.nz and click on Help Save the Kiwi of the Sea. There's a tab there, Help Save the Kiwi of the Sea. And is there a submission that people can use to help guide them there?
That's right. It's a very easy process. You just click on the tab once you've got to that site, and you will sign on to our submission, which is robust and scientifically based. It's also really powerful if you make your own submission in your own words. And the key elements to remember are that the dolphins, Maui and Hector's dolphins, need to be protected throughout their whole range, which the current draft threat management plan fails to do. So we need to protect Maui and Hector's throughout their whole range and out to 100 metres deep, because that's about as far offshore as they go. It's determined by food sources and turbidity and
what was that word you just used?
Turbidity.
Yes.
So they like murky water.
Okay.
And so that the extent of their range is at max 100 metres deep, water 100 metres deep, and yet the threat management plan fails to protect them throughout their whole range and to that water depth. So ask for protection throughout the dolphin's whole range, out to 100 metres deep. Ask for protection from new and extended seabed mining and oil and gas exploration and exploitation, because at the moment there's a whole lot of expansion of existing permits within Maui and Hector's range. And the third thing that it's really important to ask for is cameras, electronic monitoring on all the fishing fleet that's operating in Maui and Hector's range as well.
Yes, that seems a really good idea, to keep an eye on those fishermen. But I mean, I noticed when I looked at a map of where there was protection for Maui's and Hector's dolphins, that sort of Taranaki down Whanganui down to Wellington, there's nothing there. And that's where they're doing quite a lot of drilling and things, isn't it? So we're going to have a bit of a conflict there. We've got to be very outspoken, haven't we?
That's right. There is a lot of pressure on the areas that don't have protection. And even though the threat management plan does suggest an option four for Maui and Hector's dolphins, that part of that coastline will have additional protection. It's only one of the options. And it still doesn't go to 100 metres offshore. It doesn't cover the full offshore range, therefore, and it doesn't go around into Wellington Harbour, where Maui slash Hector's have been seen. And it doesn't extend a safe corridor across to the South Island. We know that some Hector's dolphins are making their way across Cook Strait and coming up as far as the west coast here in Auckland and swimming around with Maui dolphins. And if dolphins are making that passage, they are running a gauntlet of fishing vessels, but also all the potential and actual seabed mineral and oil and gas exploration in the dolphin habitat. And unfortunately, it's been up to groups like Greenpeace and Kiwis Against Seabed Mining to take some of the world's biggest companies to court. So, for example, Trans-Tasman Resources applied to do seabed mining in the South Taranaki Bight. They were sponsored by the government. So the government provided incentives for them to do this. They took it to the Environmental Protection Agency, and it's in the High Court now because on the casting vote, the chair of the hearing panel decided that it could go ahead even though the risks to Maui and Hector's dolphins and blue whales was well quantified at during those hearings. So it's left to non-governmental organisations, you know, charities, to uphold the integrity of our marine environment against some of the world's biggest extractive companies, and our government is not there upholding the protection necessary to protect these species.
So much for our clean, green New Zealand if the government doesn't support it.
We're open for business.
Ah, that's dreadful, isn't it?
Yeah.
And so what about local government? I mean, Christine, you were on a councillor for the Auckland Regional Council, and then you were on the Rodney District Council local board. So you know a lot about what happens and what sort of influence we can have as local government.
Yeah, and it's not to be underestimated. So I had 15 years in local government, so first on the Rodney District Council and then the Auckland Regional Council before the formation of the Super City. And in my time on those councils, we led campaigns, national campaigns, to get better protection for Maui and Hector's. And that did eventuate in 2008 to the creation of four new marine mammal sanctuaries and some additional protection for Maui and Hector's. And that was a really successful campaign, and it was huge. Local government, for a change, actually decided that they could take some leadership, and regional councils do have responsible for coastal management, and so they have a key role to play. And so anybody in the country should be looking to their local government representatives to be leading on this, given especially in Auckland the importance of these dolphins to our communities. And because in Auckland, you know, it's a unitary authority, so it does have very clear coastal management responsibilities. And also things like harbour master functions. So if there's a boat race in Maui dolphin habitat, then that's an issue. And in fact, that has been proposed in the past. There was a suggestion that there'd be thundercat racing off Piha. And every year there are reports of Maui dolphins swimming with surfers at Piha. And so those sort of things are really inappropriate. And yet that's the opportunity for local government to have a say in the threat management plan, but also on an ongoing basis to make sure that their coastal management functions and port development and other infrastructure that councils are responsible for does no harm to dolphins. And at the moment, we can't say that councils are actively showing leadership in this issue. That I'd be very surprised if many, if any, are making submissions on this.
What about Auckland Council?
Well, Auckland, we've had mixed messages from them over the last few weeks. They were pretty apathetic when me and our other campaign advisor for World Animal Protection New Zealand made a presentation to them in March. And we followed up with that a few weeks ago, just saying, well, you know, threat management plan's open for submissions. I'm just checking that you're making a submission. And in my initial response, I was told that actually, no, it was going to be handed over to a biosecurity special interest group, and there was nothing more that could be done. So I was quite unhappy about that, and I followed up with the councillors to ensure that they were taking some leadership. And unfortunately, for several weeks, I didn't receive a response from most of them. In fact, got a response from only one. And when I followed up that with the threat, I think, of shaming them, because they should be ashamed, they've now come back and said, yep, they'll be making submissions consistent with the approach that was developed when I was a councillor.
Right.
So I expect that Auckland Council will be making a submission, and I should think so too, given that these dolphins, Maui dolphins, are only found, and the biggest concentration of them, if you can say that, when there's only about 57 adults, is on our Auckland West Coast. So it's a very clear moral and legal responsibility of Auckland Council to take action.
It certainly is. And I feel now that I should write a letter to them and say something too.
You should.
I remember going on one of the most amazing demonstrations that you ran a few years ago when we took cut-out cardboard dolphins and placed them outside John Key's office, and we walked up along the main road and down under a tunnel in Cumeu.
That's right. It was beautiful, wasn't it?
It was a wonderful demonstration. It was so positive.
Oh, good.
I mean, anybody who thinks, oh, I don't want to go on a protest, it doesn't have to be a big negative deal.
That's right. And that was a real celebration of these beautiful dolphins that we all love. Ironically, we've found it much more challenging to get people mobilised in this term of government, because people who love dolphins tended to be cynical, rightfully so, about the national government. But people have a lot of hope in this newish, it's not even new anymore, is it, in this Labor-led government. And so people are reluctant to call them to account. And that's quite disappointing, because they really need to be called to account, no matter who it is and no matter how much confidence we have in them. They have to, you know, politicians and decision makers need to know that we're watching them and that we want them to honour their pre-election promises. And unfortunately, 4 days after forming the coalition government, the Labor Party and the new Minister for Fisheries at the time, Stuart Nash, met with the fishing industry and came out of that meeting saying that there would be no cameras on the fishing fleet, which contradicted the national government. You know, who would have thought? The national government's promise to have cameras on every fishing vessel by October last year. So 4 days after being forming a coalition government, they actually moved back on their promises from before the election and said, no, actually, this isn't such a priority for us after all. And so even now, with promises to have cameras on the Maui dolphin fishing fleet, which, you know, Maui dolphins are not at the same risk of entanglement as Hectors are, because they have much more protection. And yet, I think a PR move, the government have said, oh, yeah, we're going to put cameras on every boat fishing in Maui habitat. Well, you know, that's not as important. Not to say that Maui aren't important, because they are and there are so few of them, but that's leaving Hectors and the vast amount of fishing that goes on in the Hectors habitat unscrutinised, and that's really inappropriate. We can't rely on self-regulation or self-monitoring, and there's plenty of evidence from around the world to show that.
Well, as soon as money is involved, of course. And this is the issue all the time. I mean, once upon a time, it was the sugar industry that manipulated governments, and then that became the alcohol industry, and now it's becoming just about every industry that seems to have more power than the democratic voice.
And the fishing industry seems to have a disproportionate amount of power.
In New Zealand, yes.
And partly I think that's because there are, you know, they're quite significant donors for election campaigns. It's a revolving door and a circle of trust where politicians have close relationships with the seafood industry bigwigs. And there are tame scientists who provide advice that reinforces existing views in a conservative way. And so that's really challenging. And yet it defies the evidence. For example, World Animal Protection Commission, two economic reports from an independent economic analysis company called Market Economics. And it found that there'd be much more value from protecting the whole dolphin habitat out to 100 metres deep from the positives, from tourism and, you know, a premium on New Zealand products, from doing the right thing. So those costs were not even looked at in the threat management plan. And at the same time, they overstated the cost to the fishing industry by up to 4 times. So they understated the value of protection and overstated the cost of protection, and, you know, so are actually portraying an inaccurate and incomplete record of the wider implications of saving these dolphins.
And, you know, I think that we're going to have a problem, because a lot of people now are realising the impact of the meat and dairy industry on climate change in particular, as well as waterways. And so they're sort of changing a little bit, and so the fish consumption is going to increase. And this is not very helpful when there have been people saying that, well, the world could be out of fish in by 2050 or whatever, or less. So we possibly have to consider fish consumption.
Yes, well, when you look at the scale of damage that's being done by industrial scale harvesting and the fact that these fisheries are indiscriminate, work from the University of Auckland Business School found that three times amount of fish is dumped as is landed. And that's caused the call for a review of our whole fisheries management, because there's high grading going on where if the fish that people haul up doesn't get them enough value, then they'll turf that overboard and go fishing for higher value fish. So high grading, dumping of non-target species, bycatch, and not just dolphins but sea lions, birds, you name it, bottom trawling. There are so many injustices being imposed on the marine environment, and because it happens out there beyond the line of sight of most of us, people are maybe not aware of it, or people just put that to one side because we've got to eat something. But actually, the industrial scale fishing, that there's no way that is sustainable.
No, I think we need to hear more about that in the news.
Yeah, we do.
Mind you, we're the news too.
Yeah.
But look, I'm just a bit concerned about, is climate change going to affect the Mauis and Hector's dolphins?
Inevitably, and in a number of ways. There is some evidence with warming sea temperatures that the distribution of the dolphins is changing, and it hasn't really been tested yet. It's a hypothesis. But there's some suspicion that as the seas warm and the dolphins' prey species move, that the dolphins will therefore move. And if we have lines on a map that are too rigid about where the dolphins are safe and where the netting is allowed to go on, as soon as those dolphins cross that line, then they're at risk. And so we need to be building the precautionary principle into any management and protection regime that's developed under the threat management plan. But then there are other things, other impacts with climate change too. You know, if the sea just gets too warm, or as sediment distribution changes, then that can have an impact on the dolphins as well. A lot of that hasn't even been looked at yet.
Algae bloom.
That's right.
It needs to be looked at.
Yeah.
It does. Now, I'm Lisa Eyre, and I have in the studio with me Christine Rose, and she's talking about dolphins, and also the World Animal Protection.org organisation that she's involved with. So this is Green Planet FM. Now, if you would like to make a submission on the dolphins, and this needs to be in by the 19th of August.
10 a.m. on the 19th of August, which is a Monday. So actually, write your submission now, get it, and then you can have a clear conscience.
Yeah, good idea. So you go to www.worldanimalprotection.org.nz and click on Help Save the Kiwi of the Sea. So, Christine, tell me a little more now about the other animals that you're involved with the World Animal Protection.
World Animal Protection is a global organisation. We've been around for about 70 years and we work in about 50 countries around the world. And I'm very lucky to be one of two staff only in New Zealand. And, you know, I feel very honoured because it's an organisation that I have held in high regard. They used to be called WSPA, the World Society for the Protection of Animals. And I've been a supporter of their work for about 15 years. So, you know, every month I make a donation. And so when I got this job last year, it was perfect. And it's a great organisation. And we're moving the world for animals. And our ambition is to have a world without suffering for animals, and where the life of every animal matters. So we have four main campaign areas: animals in communities, animals in disasters, animals in farming, and animals in the wild. And animals in communities, it's about recognising the important relationships and the humanising effect that having relationships with animals has. And so, for example, we work in communities with vaccinations against rabies so that animals aren't dogs aren't demonised and killed inhumanely, and so that they have a life worth living, because we want every animal to have a life worth living.
Great.
And so we'll go into those communities and do vaccinations and also sterilisations so that there might be fewer animals, but they have a better quality of life and people aren't living in fear of getting diseases from them, so they can have a mutually respectful relationship. And that's a really important realm of work that we do, mainly in the developing countries. We work in response to disasters, so especially where countries don't have the capacity themselves to go in there and provide vet treatment, emergency food and water supplies. And we know that if there is a disaster, that communities are reluctant to leave their animals, because often that's where all their wealth is, and also they love the animals, and so they don't want to leave a disaster zone because they don't want to leave their animals. And so if we can get in there and provide the necessary help and health-giving properties, then it means that the people's economic recovery will be quicker, their social recovery will be quicker, and there'll be less suffering for animals.
Well, certainly bushfires are the ones that really worry me about animals, and that they're left to burn.
Yeah.
Because you can't take a whole flock of sheep with you.
No.
When you evacuate.
No, and so as a result, people are inclined to stay, you know, because they want to stay with their animals. And so we do as much work as we can. You know, I mean, there are lots of disasters, and with climate change we'll probably see more, but whether it's a volcano or a monsoon or a drought, we have a team that's ready and mobilised to go out and attend to the emergency needs of animals in communities. A big part of our work is animals and farming, because unfortunately we know at the moment there are about 70 billion animals farmed every year, and that's set to probably double by 2050. And even though we would love to live in a world where no animals suffer, farming is a fact of life. And so we work to ensure that the animal husbandry systems are the best that they can be. And ironically, with pigs, for example, sometimes it's places like Brazil and Thailand and China that are developing and upscaling their industries that have higher animal welfare standards than countries like New Zealand, where our infrastructure is old, and the age of that infrastructure is often used as a reason why we can't reform the way we farm, because, you know, it'll cost so much money to build new piggeries or to change processes. And so when I grew up on a pig farm down near Rotorua as a child, those practices of castrating piglets without anaesthetic, chopping off their tails without anaesthetic, you know, taking them from their mums, the farrowing crates where pigs can't turn around, the sows can't turn around, where they can't create a bed or a nest for their babies. All these things that are part of a natural behaviour for animals are denied to them here in New Zealand. And so pigs, chooks, even, you know, that industrial scale sort of terrible mistreatment of animals is because we've only got so much money, and we have to focus on where the intensity and scale of suffering is greatest. And so even though the images of cows and their bellies up to their bellies in mud, that's horrific, and that's an animal welfare issue, and we try and address those things in live animal shipments. And you know, little lambs dying in snow, you know, this past weekend's a classic example of the terrible things that we inflict upon animals. But because we've only got limited capacity, we do run structured campaigns on Raise Pigs Right and A Better Life for Chickens, as well as some of those ancillary, you know, what's considered conventional farming in New Zealand. So we do a lot of work with that. And then our last campaign area is animals in the wild. And so that's why we're focusing on dolphins here in New Zealand. But we also deal with wildlife, not pets. So, you know, African grey parrots or Indian star tortoises or exotic animals that people think are going to be cute to have as a pet are often taken from the wild, many of them, you know, at least half of them die by the time they make it to the pet shop, and then often they have a life of misery. So Wildlife Not Pets is one of those sub-campaigns, and then we also have Wildlife Not Entertainers. And so we've been doing a lot of work in Thailand, for example, where actually it's Westerners, people coming from New Zealand and Australia, that are going to Thailand to ride an elephant or have a selfie with a tiger that imposes a life of suffering on those animals. And we, because we're a science-based organisation, we make sure that we do all our research to properly quantify the animal welfare impacts on these animals before we go into these countries and say, hey, you shouldn't be doing that. And we also try and develop alternative livelihoods for these people, because we know that often, again, labour abuses and animal welfare abuses go hand in hand. And so if we want to end cruelty to animals, we actually also have to see that as hand in hand with ending cruelty to workers. And so we try, for example, with our bear campaigns, taking bears out of the bear bile industry and also using bears for entertainment. In one instance, we bought a general store for a person who had been exploiting bears, and we took those bears to a refuge, and you can see the new life that those bears have on our Facebook page and our website, and it's beautiful to see.
And that the website's theworldanimalprotection.org.
That's right, yeah. And so you can see our great successes there, and how the lives of those bears have been improved, but also the lives of those people have been improved because they've got a general store. So we haven't just gone in there and said, we're taking your bears. We don't care if you starve. We've said, here, we've given you an alternative livelihood, this general store, as long as you don't go back to exploiting bears.
Right. Oh, well, that's wonderful. So just going back to New Zealand and wildlife, how about 1080?
Yeah, we have concerns about animal welfare impacts of 1080, and not just 1080, but other methods of controlling what are deemed to be pests and predators.
Yes.
And it's really concerning that the Predator-Free 2050 campaign is being used to vilify animals and to deny them rights to welfare. And it's become sort of this polarised debate, and you know, as if it's appropriate to bash a possum or to drown a cat or, you know,
had school children drowning possums.
Yeah, you know, we should be very concerned about what the goal of environmental integrity in terms of, you know, a pre-settled New Zealand, you know, trying to chase nirvana and therefore belittling the life and the value of lives of all these other animals. And so while we recognise that species level, it's really important to have kōkako and mohua. You know, that's really a value. It's a global value. But we need to make sure that we don't lose our humanity in trying to balance ecosystem or species level protection and balance that with individual animal welfare as well.
Well, that's my opinion, is that we have to have certain areas for the native birds where they're protected, and the other areas we have to let Mother Nature do it herself.
Yes, well, the forces of nature are pretty powerful, and I think it's an emerging field, and we're quite immature in New Zealand in grappling with this.
Yes.
Whether it's harking back to the sort of colonial era where, you know, we're just going to create a little England and bring in all the weasels and stoats and rabbits. And now as this sort of ethic is developing, we're vilifying those introduced species. It's not their fault that they were brought into this country, and they shouldn't suffer just because we've got an alternative goal, which is species level protection. You know, and I mean, I love birds. But, you know, I think we do need to question how we are now, you know, using a sledgehammer to crack a walnut and losing some of that sensitivity and some of that nuance because it's all Predator-Free 2050.
I've seen a rabbit dying from myxomatosis in the UK, and I've seen a rabbit dying from 1080 here. Both the suffering was horrendous, and I just thought, how can we as humans do that to another sentient being? It's terrible. I mean, we're talking about we must not allow these dolphins to drown down in the water, but at least, I mean, that's quicker than what an animal goes through with 1080. So, yeah.
Yeah.
It's so important to try and keep a consistency, isn't it?
Yeah.
Of integrity. We don't want people to suffer. We don't want animals to suffer.
Yeah, and it's classic with our relationship with animals that, you know, I've got a companion, a little white companion, my rabbit, Dougie, and he's very loved. And I know that he's got a huge character, and yet if he had grey fur and he was in the paddock, he'd be demonised as a pest and people wouldn't care how much he suffered. Yet there's no difference between Dougie and the wild rabbit. It's just this arbitrary categorisation that we apply. And, you know, it's the same with rats, the same with cats. You know, to a degree in developing countries, the same with dogs. And actually we should have respect for the sentience and the agency and the will to life in every animal.
Absolutely, yes.
And so in World Animal Protection, we do get a lot of questions about 1080, and we don't have the capacity to run an anti-1080 campaign. We know it's a real concern to New Zealanders, and we support the call for more humane treatment of animals, whatever type of animal they are.
Yes, right down to rats.
Yep. Rats are beautiful too.
I've had pet rats and a pet possum.
we had a pet possum. and you know, you're not allowed to have a pet possum. You know, if you take a wild rabbit to the vet to get treated, a vet is not supposed to treat that rabbit.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because it's vermin.
Oh, I didn't know
yeah.
that.
Yeah. Ooh. Seems incredible. I rescued a rabbit. It was actually in a pet shop. It had been in a pet shop its whole life. And just appalling. And so I bought this rabbit, and so that I could give it a better life, not at my place. I took it to my mum and dad's, and now he's a free-range rabbit. But his whole life he'd been in this pet shop. No one wanted him because he looked like a wild bunny.
Right.
You know, I mean, we're so fickle. And so, you know, if he'd been white, maybe people would have bought him. But because he was tawny, people didn't want him. So his whole life in this miserable little cage, and when I took him to the vet to get neutered, the vet sort of laughed at me and said, "This is a wild rabbit. I'm not actually allowed to treat this rabbit." And fortunately, I said, "Well, I bought it from a pet shop, so somebody's been taken for a ride here." But so I got him neutered, and now he lives the life that every rabbit should live. But, you know,
except for one thing.
Yeah, that's right. He probably doesn't miss it, actually, because he's not going to get in a fight with other rabbits. So
true.
He won't miss.
Oh, right. Okay. So from a New Zealand perspective, are you just working in New Zealand, or are you involved with things overseas?
I'm involved with overseas things too, and partly that's because here, you know, as a developed country, we're drivers of bad things happening overseas. So whether it's, you know, the elephant riding in Thailand or even in Australia, you think about the number of people from New Zealand who unwittingly they take their families to SeaWorld to watch captive dolphins and whales, or dolphins in particular, you know, and orca. And so we need to stop the demand, and where that demand is driven by relatively well-off countries like New Zealand, we've got a role to play. And so we work in country, but we also work in New Zealand as the source of some of this demand.
Now, just a question about SeaWorld. I took my kids there, and quite a while ago, I felt that it did good in that it got people to love the dolphins and that were there. So I just wonder whether it wouldn't be better to have better conditions for them, but still have something like that. Because I was appalled at the conditions. I didn't expect them to be as bad as they were, and small spaces for them to swim around in. I thought it would be much better than that. So I haven't sent to my grandkids. But it's a bit like the zoos as well. You've got to look at the position of how they do actually make people love animals and want to protect them.
A life in captivity is no life for any animal. you know, these are wild animals, and in the wild they would swim hundreds of k's a day and dive to great depths, and that those conditions can never be replicated in captivity. And, you know, you don't have to see an animal to love it. So you think about how dinosaurs captivate the imagination of children. They've never seen a dinosaur. They'll never see a dinosaur. But a child can reel off the name of a dozen different dinosaurs. And with, artificial reality and holograms and everything, you could replicate what that animal looks like without it, without sacrificing the quality of life of the animal in a zoo or in captivity. And the irony about SeaWorld is that many of these places are within a stone's throw of the coast. And Australia is a classic example. You've got SeaWorld, and then you can go to the beach, you know, not even 20 minutes drive away, and you will see dolphins, whales, sharks, turtles. So you don't need to see an animal to fall in love with it. That's the point about the dinosaurs. But you don't need to go to somewhere that keeps those animals in captivity to see the animals either, you know. And I think that's the greatest, one of the greatest sad things about these aquaria and marine parks is that, you know, people go to them to see a dolphin, that if they just, you know, if they went to the beach, they'd see the dolphins. But those dolphins in captivity and the orca in captivity would be able to smell the sea. And yet they're denied the access to it.
Yeah. No, I was appalled at the way they were kept there, I must admit. And you're quite right. Now we have...
Virtual reality.
Virtual reality. I mean, look, the new movie, The Lion King, what they can do with all of this sort of thing. So it can be done, and we don't need to have those places to go to anymore.
No, and sometimes they're justified by saying that they have conservation purposes or that they rehabilitate animals. But you can decouple using animals for entertainment from rehabilitation and, you know, welfare. And our argument is that, you know, that rehabilitation and the welfare should and education should stand on their own. You don't need to exploit and humiliate an animal. You know, because I think about, and you see some of those pictures of animals in zoos where people are jeering at them or calling at them to get a response. So they've got this life of boredom and humiliation. You know, no wonder orca go mad and kill their trainers sometimes.
Yes, yes. Absolutely. And of course we have moved, because we did have animals in circuses and now we don't. So the general public thing has moved. When I was about 10, I think I refused to go to a circus because of the use of animals. And I mean, in those days, way back when, we didn't have a lot of information, but it was just my own observation. That animals shouldn't be treated like
some things you can look at and you just know they're wrong. Yeah. So you look at the way pigs are kept, even in New Zealand, and you can look at that and you know that's wrong.
I love bacon, but I've given it up.
I mean, I don't eat bacon. I don't eat meat. And, you know, looking at the way those pigs are raised, and not just pigs, but I cannot inflict that. You know, for a moment of pleasure on the palate is a life of suffering for a pig.
Now, something that occurred to me when you were talking earlier, now we've started milking goats and sheep and even deer. Because there's a wish for non-cow products, people like me who are dairy intolerant, I'm a bit concerned that it's okay to do that, you know. I mean, cows for generations have been milked, but these animals haven't so much, more in the Middle East, but not down here. And I'm thinking, well, I hope they're okay being milked. Have you had looked into any of that?
Not so much, because as you say, it's an emerging field and we focus on scale and intensity impacts. But as you say, also, domesticated animals have had tens of thousands of years of breeding and sort of cultural development to live with us. I mean, I must say, cows certainly weren't farmed in their thousands and then treated like an industrial commodity with the automatic cups put on, and, you know, that that's not what the original relationship was with as domestication evolved.
Sitting on a three-legged stool.
Yeah.
Talking to a daisy while she chewed the cud.
It's a much nicer relationship.
Yeah.
And so I think even now, even with cows, we've moved so far away from what that relationship used to be like, and that's why you see farmers, you know, I know it's not all of them, but, you know, snap a cow's tail because it was flicking poo in the cow shed, or, you know, beating a cow because it didn't move quickly enough, or killing a cow because it's not, you know, delivering enough babies or whatever, you know. So I think we're shocking, and we've moved so far away from that mutually supportive relationship that we originally had with
and
domesticated
respect.
Animals.
And respect.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, we don't have much respect anymore, do we? And in fact, people don't want to know where their milk comes from, or where their steak came from, or where their bacon came from, because it's an inconvenient truth.
It is indeed. And how often can you take a child to see a cow actually being milked and then have a drink of the milk?
Yeah, well, look, they tried to outlaw it, didn't they, natural milk?
Yes.
So,
yes.
Yeah, it's all supporting that, again, industrialisation and commodification of animals and the animal welfare. You know, when you think about Ministry for Primary Industries, it's got, I think, is it 22 inspectors for the whole country or something like that?
Is that all?
And, you know, 1% or so of complaints on animal welfare grounds are even investigated, let alone upheld. I don't think those are correct figures, but it's a terribly, terribly low number of enforcement agencies and of compliance that is followed up. So, you know, we can't, you know, Damien O'Connor was in the media over the last few days saying, oh, you know, we haven't got that much resource and we don't need to. We can trust people.
Perhaps we could take some from the Ministry of Defence, Mr. O'Connor.
Yeah, I'd recommend that.
Yes, yes. Well, I've really enjoyed talking to you. I really love your whole approach to animals, and I hope the listeners do too, because it's so important that we don't just treat humans with respect, that we treat those that live on the planet with us with respect as well.
They're the innocents in all of this, and we're imposing so much on the environment and on them personally, and, you know, they deserve better.
They do. They deserve better. So thank you very much again.
Thank you.
It's been awesome. And no doubt I'll call you in again sometime.
Lovely. I look forward to it.
Thanks, Christine.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning into this Green Planet radio show. I trust you have derived both enjoyment and insight as we empower ourselves with a greater understanding of the magnificent, multifaceted world that we inhabit. In these coming times of rapid change, it's going to take raw courage and inner resolve. And so I thank you as we all remain both focused yet relaxed as we challenge the status quo and let go of the old as we energetically co-create the new paradigm. Because I can assure you, every one of you are important now. When you go to bed tonight, ready for well-earned rest and sleep, realize that what you think, feel, and do is part of your unfolding destiny. And when we commit to a higher act of goodwill and or community service, Providence also lines up. So that every conversation we have, every email we send, every phone call we make, and every meeting we attend, that we stand in our power and communicate intelligently, warmly, with integrity, knowing that we are actively shaping a collective future that will benefit all our children and grandchildren, as well as that of a larger community. This is Tim Lynch in Auckland from Nuclear Free New Zealand, and mobilizing unity consciousness, wishing you a stupendous week of heartfelt success. I say bye-bye and hari rā.